Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am exceptionally excited about today's program and today's interview. It centers around a truly fascinating book called Wisconsin for Kennedy, the primary that launched a president and changed the course of history. As you might gather from that title, this book focuses on the 1960 Wisconsin primary, which John F. Kennedy ultimately won. And this turned out to be a critical turning point in JFK's aspirations to ultimately gain the presidency, which, of course, we all know he did. What really has not been told, one of the things, of course, that's also interesting about this book is that this primary unfolded against a very different political landscape than we have today. And it was also a time when the whole nature of primaries was different than it is now. Also, this is the story behind the scenes, some at least sort of in the spotlight, but not in the spotlight the way, of course, that John F. Kennedy was. But men and women both who played a very critical role in Senator Kennedy's ultimate victory in the Wisconsin primary. All of this is told in this fascinating book by B.J. Hollers, who is actually a year of plenty, a family season of grief, go west, young man, a family and son, a father and son rediscover America on the Oregon Trail. He is also the editor of Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in a Pandemic, and more. This book is published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, again titled.
Hey, Gregory, thanks so much for having me.
And as I read those titles off, I find myself sad that we have not talked before, because it sounds like you've written several really intriguing books that I look forward to exploring on my own, but I'm very happy that we can have this conversation. I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about assuming that if you felt like you were, in a sense, swimming in unfamiliar waters by writing such a large extent politics.
Absolutely. Well, great question. And certainly, let me begin by saying I have all the respect in the world for historians who do that work so well. And certainly, I stand on the shoulders of giants within that. And I think the final thing I'll say on this front, it's the quote that drove this whole book. It's by Rudyard Kipling, and he said, if history were told in the form of stories, it would never be forgotten. And so I really took that to heart. It was my North Star, and I hope I've managed to pull that off.
I think you write very early in the book, in your preface or introduction or what it is, that you were hoping to brush the dust from this history. But very soon after, maybe two sentences later, you say, but at no point did I sacrifice historical fact for a creative flourish. I think that's really well put. And it also speaks to something that probably happens far too often when books like this are written. That is, in the interest of brushing the dust off history, making it as interesting as possible, making it come alive, there will be that temptation to step over the line of sticking with the facts. Was that a serious temptation at all, or are you just such an upright citizen that right from the start?
In these two poles where we want desperately to tell these stories any way we can so they'll be of interest, and so there's always that back of your mind, well, I'm not sure he smiled blowing through the trees. It was meant to, you know, add more creative flourish at the expense of the fact. That's just, if we're here to tell stories and tell historical stories, we owe it to the people involved to do it right.
Right. You mentioned in the author's note that it was the spring of 2020. That, of course, was the spring that the COVID-19 pandemic unleashed its fury, involved the Wisconsin primary. Tell us more about that. I'm also curious to know what you were searching for when you stumbled across this. I mean, were you at that point thinking about writing some kind of a book about Mr. Kennedy, or for some other reason were you searching this particular treasure trove when you came across this series of transcripts that ended up being so valuable to you?
Well, that is a great question. You know, it's hard to remember the exact mindset at that time. I think a part of me, given the COVID concerns, I just wanted to take my mind somewhere else for a while, you know? And so on our university wall, there's a photograph of then Senator John F. Kennedy from the JFK Museum and Oral History Project. I kept going. I found a different interview. One person kind of led to another, and pretty soon, Kenosha connection too. You might get to it, so I'll save that for later. But just seeing some of these moments, I thought, we have to share this more widely, not just for the history, but also for what it means for today's political scene.
Right. You do go on in the author's note to mention others who have written about this particular matter, and you list a number of different writers and historians and so on. And I'm really glad that you also mentioned documentarian Robert Drew. It wasn't terribly long ago that I ended up purchasing a DVD from the highly regarded Criterion Collection, and it something called the, including one that very specifically focused on the Wisconsin primary. I suspect that is a film that you watched maybe more than once. Could you just say a quick word about this really interesting film?
Oh, my goodness. It's so funny you bring that up. Here's the interesting backstory. I bought that same list of stand in the schoolhouse door. I've also written a book called Opening the Doors, and it's all about the desegregation of the University of Alabama. I taught maybe 100 yards or less from that Foster Auditorium or that moment store, and I noticed I happen to have the other film in that collection already purchased, and that is Primary by Robert Drew, which, as you mentioned, recounts the entire Wisconsin primary. What's so wild is when I first watched this, when I was first embarking on this project, I was looking in the background for faces, trying to figure out, do I know anyone here other than Jack Kennedy? I knew no one. And then family members, and they've never seen this footage. So being able to then share this video with, you know, Ira Kappenstein's son, who's never seen this before, his dad's 4 feet away from the future president, you know, it's just moving to look at the people in the background of the scenes and to know that they were valuable as well.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with B.J. Hollers, who is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and we are talking about his most recent book. B.J. Hollers' book examines John F. Kennedy's victory in the Wisconsin primary following Mr. Kennedy and his advisors and assistants as they crisscross the state in an exhaustive in an exhausting effort on October 28th, 1959, or maybe I should say your book does not literally begin there, but of his brother Bobby. Explain who was gathered on October 28th, 1959, and the nature of this critically important conversation.
Oh, well, thank you for pointing that out. And of course, when you're writing any kind of book or any kind of narrative nonfiction, you've got to make so many choices. And so it was really a pivotal one. Where do I start this story? Do we start it when he announces the Wisconsin primary? Do we back it up when he's first debating the route for the presidency? And so I chose the latter here. And as you said, it's exactly right. We're at Hyannisport. We're at the Kennedy compound there. We're in Bobby's living room. His parents are next door. Jack Kennedy's there listening. 13 or 14 folks are gathered, close friends, political allies. And it was really a chance to be very candid. I mean, Bobby was sort of running the show as kind of ad hoc campaign manager at that time, and they're working through would not be rooting for his best shot for his brother. The big question was whether or not Wisconsin was going to be a part of that, and there were some very different perspectives on that. It was a dangerous place. Joe Kennedy.
And of course, now you have to pretend you're a professor of political science rather than English.
Here we go.
But I mean, nevertheless, it's an important thing for us to understand. And it's this whole notion of, I want to be president of the United States. I want to be the Democratic nominee. Should I or should I not enter some state primaries? I mean, in 2024, it's just unfathomable to think about a road to the presidential nominee that would not involve being involved in primaries. But this was right. A very different world back then, and the whole situation was set up in such a way that state primaries were, in a sense, an option. And So if you could explain that, I think it would be very, very helpful at this point in the conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And trust me, this was an education for me, especially when we go back 50 years. We kind of sort of know how things occasionally work today, but looking at historical perspective is really compelling. And so, as you pointed out, back in those days, the primary route, they were often thought of more as the national convention, and sometimes they keep their delegate vote for you. Other times they might change their mind. And so it was complex in a lot of ways. The big bosses, the big political leaders, they kind of ran the show behind the scenes. It was kind of, Kennedy knew he did not have that advantage. And so he had to win a series of state primaries. He thought he had to win them all, which was likely true, in order to prove to the bosses, to prove that he wasn't just some East Coast politician, that he could win in the Midwest, he could win in the West, he could win the entire election as needed. And so he had did one event after another, shook a million hands, wrote thank you notes. His relatives were doing teas throughout the state, and that kept up through West Virginia and beyond. West Virginia was another major event. It was a head-to-head matchup between Hubert Humphrey, kind of a rematch of Wisconsin, and it wasn't until after West Virginia that Kennedy was in a position to really make a strong case for himself at the national convention.
One of the things you tell us about this critically important meeting in October of 1959, and we should maybe also add that no final decision was made in that meeting about which primary should be their efforts. That was yet to be determined. But you do tell us that Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy's sort of de facto unofficial campaign manager at that point in time, did not think
Bobby wasn't sure how that would play. But even more formidable was the idea of running against Hubert Humphrey. I mean, Hubert Humphrey was often called the senator from next door over in Minnesota. He had done more for Wisconsinites than even our own.
Go after trying to win nation. One of the things you mentioned is that they had to decide which primaries he would enter. And at this point in time, there were 16 options, of which Wisconsin was only one.
For president, and Wisconsinite looks up and says, president of what? Like, he hadn't even heard of this guy, you know? And so there was all of that to contend with. Also, having it in Humphrey's home turf. I mean, that was a big head-to-head challenge. If he could best Humphrey on his own turf, that would send a very strong message to the delegates. It would kind of speak to his electability, and it would give him some more news because they love the star power of the Kennedy women. You had Ted Kennedy, who's literally jumping off a ski jump in Middleton, Wisconsin on Valentine's Day 1960 to kind of showcase that. He famously said that she didn't really like anyone in Wisconsin who wasn't working for her husband's campaign. You know, I think Jack
be one of the first. What difference that made in terms of what John Kennedy did?
Yes. So an open primary simply means that folks from any political party can vote for anyone they want in the primary. And so there's always this fear of if there are enough Republican voters voting in a Democratic primary, that was a factor. I'm not sure. There's some different theories on whether or not that was actually a major factor or not. But it was, again, it was a close race. And so when you've got all of these wild cards at work, you know, a state that doesn't know Jack Kennedy, a state that was still weighing the religion question, would Protestants vote? A district he thought he would win in Wisconsin. And some say the number was as high as 10. He thought he was going to sweep the state. That was not the case. Again, he won 6 out of 10. And had he won 5 out of 10, it would have shaken up everything. Pat Lucy talks about, he's, of course, the former governor of Wisconsin, had
them. And then you say they decided they would simply restack the deck, change the course of history. Your book actually gives us, you know, and it is, of course, an exhausting gauntlet. And I think one of the things that your book really helped me understand is one of the great advantages to a candidate undertaking this. This is what you write. In addition to proving to skeptical convention delegates that Jack was ready for the national election, Bobby knew the primaries offered one final advantage. By enduring the primary gauntlet, Jack would emerge better prepared for the general election against Richard Nixon. Every whistle stop was the equivalent of a political push-up. The more you did, the stronger you became. Honestly, that had never really occurred to me before, that would be one purpose of this kind of campaign or this phase of the campaign is just practicing what you would need to do on an even higher plane in an even brighter national spotlight if indeed you became your party's nominee for president. And from the way you frame this, it sounds like Wisconsin proved to be exceptionally true in this regard.
Absolutely. What a great observation. I mean, I always say that Wisconsin did not go easy on John F. Kennedy, but that was ultimately to his advantage. When he came back to visit Milwaukee in 1962, he's president now, he gave a speech. And at that speech, he said, quote, "I suppose that there's no training ground for the presidency, but I don't think it's a bad idea for a president to have stood outside of Meyer's Meat Factory in Madison, Wisconsin at 5:30 in the morning with the temp." Got that from Pat Lucey. Pat Lucey, of course, was no stranger to campaigning in Wisconsin. He said, you got to win over everyone. You need to have, perhaps he was not loved in order to try to show people, I'm unafraid to show my face here. I'm going to try. And so I love Wisconsin as the training ground. It was cold. We were not terribly friendly early in the book when he's visiting in March. There are towns where no one shows up. Theodore, it's so different than the idea of John F. Kennedy we have today. You know, he's the guy on the 50-cent piece, he's all over the place, but back then people didn't even know who he was in Wisconsin in some respects.
Right. And of course, that's one thing that is kind of an interesting, and at least in general, the Kennedys had a very high profile and right. Certainly were celebrities and had charisma to an extent. But in a way, that charisma, that fame did not necessarily extend to the streets of tiny towns in rural Wisconsin, or maybe even to certain neighborhoods in certain cities. I mean, it was not, right. He was not famous everywhere. And for sure, he was not liked everywhere.
Unknown he may have been in some of the smaller towns, but you know who wasn't unknown? Hubert Humphrey. I mean, Hubert Humphrey was everywhere. He was shaking hands. He loved farmers and farmers loved him. And so just the star power of these two side by side. There's a Life magazine image. It's actually in the book where you see both John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey standing next to each other in Clintonville, Wisconsin, next to this big red barn. And just the contrast. There's a whole scene just describing the contrast because one looks like a Hollywood movie star and the other one looks like a kind of a farmer himself, and Humphrey just could not catch a break. He lacked the star power because everyone felt like he was the neighbor next door. And yet, sadly, people in Wisconsin, and I think it's just being human, in some instances, we prefer the celebrity. We prefer looking at the person who is not us rather than the person who maybe best reflects our own intentions and motives. And so God bless Hubert Humphrey. The more I researched this book, the more I thought I might have been a Humphrey man myself, but he just could not pull it off. And so
Johnson primary. By every measure, they were an incredible truth behind those intriguing words. Tell us more about the eclectic team that was formed around him and to whatever extent that was a very conscious choice on Mr. Kennedy's part.
Yes, I think so. And I often describe them as kind of like an Ocean's 11 political team. You watch those movies and everyone has their role. Someone unlocks the safe. Someone works with the camera. Someone drives the getaway car, and it's kind of like that. Not to say on the campaign and had
Jerry Bruno is a wonderful guy for us to talk about because of his connection to Kennedy. I'm sorry, because of his connection to Kenosha. And one of the things that I really appreciate is when you tell us about this man who's come from a very privileged background of wealth, highly connected to power brokers of all kinds and so on, a day in terms of telling us about the Kennedy campaign all across the state. I paid a special attention to a chapter called Jackie Steals the Show because the date in question happens to be the day I was born, February 16th, the spotlight, Jack Kennedy's wife, Jacqueline. Can you just say a little bit about this wonderful moment?
Racing to shake her hand before they even shook his hand. She did her best. She was reading the dog speaker with the manager's permission and said, "Hello, everyone. My name is Jackie Kennedy. My husband's running for president, the presidential nomination. I'd like you to keep shopping, but I'd like to tell you a bit about why you ought to vote for him. And then she just had a conversation with the shoppers. Could you imagine going through a supermarket, hearing this voice, just standing there with your cart in the Ovaltine aisle, hearing about why you ought to vote for Jack Kennedy? It moves me deeply, the lengths people went to get this job done. The creativity never ended with the Kennedys, and I think people really recognize that, and it hit them hard.
Mm. I want to also be sure that we spend a moment talking about, he is somebody who comes aboard the Kennedy bandwagon and ultimately endorses John F. Kennedy, even though he had disappointed her in a couple of different instances by things he had either done or, in a sense, failed to do. And you tell us that
delegate. She was close friends with Humphrey and Humphrey's campaign manager. Everyone kind of was even on the scene, you know. So he was ahead of his time in terms of civil rights, whereas many have said that John F. Kennedy was a bit behind the times in civil rights. And so despite that, Vel Phillips met Kennedy a few times, kind of told him what her concerns were about him, made the person who she felt she should have been with, Humphrey, and it did cost her. It cost her personal relationships. Her mother was a huge Humphrey fan, but all the while she stuck with Kennedy, even accompanying him to the NAACP rally in July out in Los Angeles, encouraging him to go there to speak in front of NAACP members, even though other white candidates were getting booed off the stage, and he wasn't booed off the stage. They listened to him, they clapped for him, they cheered for him, and a lot of that credit goes to Vel Phillips for encouraging him.
I appreciate so much the conversation you described between the two of them, where she has the opportunity to convey her disappointment, and the way John F. Kennedy responds to that, he in that moment managed to own the mistakes that he had made as a young senator, and that was one of the things that won her over. You tell a delicious story about a lovely outfit that she was wearing that Kennedy compliments her on, and says that my wife owns the same outfit, and she suspects he's just a pandering politician, you know, kind of. So you are in this book not just talking politics, but you're really talking people. I mean, this is a book about right. human beings and the way they interact, the way they understand each other, sometimes misunderstand each other. And I should think that, you know, in the end, this probably ended up being a far richer story on that level than you could have ever imagined at the outset.
Oh, well, what a beautiful observation. And if I could have one takeaway from this book, it would be that this is not a book about politics, it's about people. And I worry that in the modern era of politics, everyone is, I guess, polished or hot mic'd. You know, there's either a controversy or it's a highly wrought campaign based on social media metrics and television commercials. But having people talk about, oh, my wife has that same dress, I mean, those are the moments that really stand out to me. And an interesting twist, a few weeks ago I was paging through the book and I realized we actually have a picture of both Vel and Jackie wearing that exact dress just pages away from each other. So I had all of this. And the fact that John Kennedy could piece this together in the middle of a photo shoot, I just love how everyone's paying attention. Everyone's looking to one another to learn something from the person next to them. No matter if you're a well-known senator or a person on the Common Council in Milwaukee, everyone has a fair shake. I think the parting thought I like to give comes from cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead. She famously said, never doubt that, I'm kind of paraphrasing, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has. And I really think this book embodies that idea. I think Wisconsinites went a long way in ensuring that was...
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure's mine.
A book about minor league baseball called Heart of the Game. Our weather forecast calls for... skies to become increasingly cloudy with some intermittent rain. High temperature of 69 degrees. Right now, of course, we have lovely sunshine. Clouds and a possibility of rain continue overnight. With a sunny tomorrow with a high of 63, and Thursday sunny with a high of 67. Continued sunny on Friday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio at exactly 9.